So we're going to take 10 weeks this summer just to think through some different parts of prayer. Because I don't know if you've ever had someone come up to you who's maybe new to faith, just trying to figure it out. In fact, that's in part one piece of my decision to take 10 Sundays to just kind of talk through some different parts of prayer. Is over the years, I've had this question asked a number of times, and I'm so thankful for it. It's like, okay, I'm new to faith. I've never had a relationship with God. So how do I do it? How do I pray? You ever had that? It's an awesome question. I hope you'll get the experience of walking someone through that. Or maybe you're wondering, maybe you're sitting here this morning and you're wondering that very question yourself. And my answer that I've given more than once, which I still stand by with an asterisk beside it that qualifies it slightly, but my answer has often been, well, it's just talking to God. You can just talk to God. He's there. He's with you. He's listening, right? And so, and I still would say that is a right answer, except if you read places like Luke chapter 11, when the disciples come to Jesus and they say, Lord, would you teach us how to pray? Notice what he doesn't do. He doesn't just turn to them and say, well, what a silly question. You just talk to God, right? There actually is an answer to that. And scripture will give us truth and teaching around how we approach God and some of the logistics and truth that we need to understand. And so I don't want to lose the simplicity and the beauty of the fact that when you come before God, he invites us to just approach him. Not on our own merit. It's because we have a Savior who's given himself in our place and now is our high priest, right? So he is there on our behalf before his Father who is all glorious and all righteous. But we need to think through some of these little bits and pieces. So there's going to be 10 different passages through the summer where we're going to think on what does Scripture teach about prayer? The other piece that kind of has gone into this is just a growing awareness that because of the beauty and power of AI, I don't know if you're noticing this, because I've had this conversation with people too. It's like, I don't know what to do in this situation. I will just go to ChatGPT and chat will tell me. Like, that's interesting, because there was a time when we came to those difficult moments, that was not an option. We were more inclined to come to God in those questions and struggles. And now, quick. In fact, I read an article, and here's one of the lines of it. And this is actually Chat responding. The author of the article has this conversation with Chat. And here's what Chat says. AI cannot be God, but it can begin to function as a functional substitute in a culture that already trends towards self-sufficiency and secularism. Like, ho, ho. Thankfully, we're not a culture that trends towards self-sufficiency and secularism. The third piece, I guess, and probably the longest standing one, is the elders have had a conviction over a number of years that one of the priorities that we feel matters to us in this season of our church life is to grow in prayer. And so those pieces put together and thought on and meditated on for a while has led to the next 10 Sundays coming up, beginning with this week. And just kind of, I hope there are, if nothing else, just pieces that you can kind of throw into your thoughts around this issue of prayer. I want to begin in Luke chapter 18. If you're in 1 Kings 3, just stay there, because that's where we're going to be. But Luke 18, just for a brief moment, is a wonderful passage. I don't think it's actually going to be one of the 10 that we're going to deal with. But Jesus speaks in Luke 18 about prayer, and he tells a parable. And often parables, I find, have a sort of a corrective bent to them. In other words, they take a way that we would tend to think or tend to believe, and then Jesus comes along and tells a story to correct a misunderstanding, right, and to set us straight. And so here's the parable he tells in Luke chapter 18, beginning in verse 9. He told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. And then he tells the story. There's two men that go up to the temple to pray, a Pharisee and a tax collector. And in the ancient world, you've got the two polar opposites. One individual who had been held in high esteem, the Pharisee, who is recognized as a very good person. He actually goes on and says, you know, I always tithe and I always fast and I do all the right things. The tax collector, on the other hand, is socially ostracized, separated from God. So everyone knew if God's going to listen to someone, it is clearly going to be the Pharisee. The tax collector's probably out of luck. And so they both go, the Pharisee prays and essentially says, God, here I am before you. I'm just so glad I'm not that guy over there. Because probably if I was like that guy, I'd be in trouble. And the tax collector, just a very simple prayer. Oh God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And Jesus says, who goes home justified? Now you have to read the parable before to kind of get your head wrapped around what he's talking about in terms of justification. I think it's more than an issue of salvation at this point, which is normally how we would think that word. I think the answer is, who goes home having had their prayer heard and having God respond? Now, if you've been around church for a while, you go, well, of course it's the tax collector, we all know. But if you go back and if we had heard that parable, I think for the very first time, you would have in your thoughts actually got to the opposite conclusion. It's like, who goes home justified? It's like, of course it's the Pharisee. Because we all know that God is good. And therefore, good people will have their prayers answered by a good God. It's just that simple and that plain. And the passage today I want to take you to, I think maybe doesn't tell us the opposite. It's not that God doesn't want his people to grow in righteousness and holiness and all and goodness. But here's the big point. Here's the big E on the I chart. Prayer is not for perfect people in perfect situations. Prayer is for imperfect people in imperfect situations. And if I can maybe get there, there would be a second part of the story in 1 Kings chapter 3, and that is this part, that sometimes before the words are off our lips, God is already answering. And I hope it's an encouragement to you in prayer. Now, the story in 1 Kings chapter 3 is probably one that you haven't spent a ton of time meditating on in a while. It's tucked away there in the pages of our Old Testament. It comes at a very interesting pivotal moment in the life of Israel. As David in chapter 1, we start chapter 1, it's one of those great statements. David was very old. And then in chapter 1 and 2, David dies. He leaves Solomon, his son, as the heir to the throne. Solomon, I'm not quite sure how to put this in a complimentary sounding sort of way. Solomon sort of mops up some of the problems. There are others who think they have to be king, and Solomon kind of resolves some of that. You can read the stories if you want to see how he does that. And by chapter 3, Solomon is now firmly in place as the king of Israel. And in an amazing moment, he has an encounter with God. Begins in verse 5, but I can't help but just go back just one verse. I hadn't intended to start in verse 4, but it's just interesting, some of the things that are going on. Let me just get to the right page here. Verse 4 says, the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon used to offer 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. And then verse 5, at Gibeon, the Lord appeared. Now, the reason that's just sort of an interesting starting point is because up till now, Gibeah has normally been associated with some very negative things. In fact, there's a lot of stories in the Bible that begin there or end there, and they're very messed up situations. In fact, even already in 1 Kings, if you were to go back over those couple of chapters, you'd see some very sinful, awful things. There's lots of murders and wars begin there and just assassinations. And in other words, when you read of a king going to Gibeah, typically you're like, oh, Solomon, don't go. Don't go. Don't you know that nothing good happens in Gibeah? And yet, as you see in verse 5, this is going to be a wonderful change from all of those past stories, because there at Gibeah, about five miles from Jerusalem, the Lord appeared, came to Solomon in a dream by night. And God said, ask what I shall give you. Now, I grew up loving. Did anyone ever play that game if you had three wishes or a genie in a bottle? It's like, somehow for me, that was just a wonderful. I know the rules of the game, right? Wish number 3 is always 3 more wishes. If anyone ever tries to trick you, it's like, really? I only get 3? It's like, go 2 big ones and then always end with a 3rd one. God comes to Solomon and says, Solomon, you can ask me for one thing. Now we're gonna see near the end of this story, this is not just a dream, right? If you look at verse 15, Solomon awoke and behold, it was a dream. Not just a dream, it was a dream. through which God initiated a conversation. Solomon, you can ask me for something. And in this conversation, in this prayer, God will speak and Solomon will speak. And as Solomon responds to it, I'll point them out, but I want you to just pay attention to three core beliefs that Solomon has about God and about himself. So here's his response if you look in verse 6. And Solomon said, "You have shown a great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart towards you." And if you went to Sunday school, you're going, that must be a different David, right? Because Solomon is actually the second child born to David and Bathsheba, the woman that Solomon committed adultery with and had her husband murdered. The first child is actually, they lose that child as a consequence of David's sin, right? And so you're reading this going, okay, Solomon, what do you believe here about God? Are you trying to suggest, Solomon, that God is like reciprocate? David was so good that then God did things good to him as a repayment for his goodness. And I think if you're at all thinking of reading it that way, let me just make sure we're reading it clearly. David was not good. God was good. If you go read Psalm 51, the thing I think that Solomon has landed on is the truth that David, a sinful man, was able to go to a good, holy God and ask forgiveness. That's the core confession. And Solomon now lands on that same conviction that there is a God who is faithful and compassionate and loving. And just as he was that way towards David, he is now that way towards Solomon. Solomon knows one thing, and it's a thing I sure hope you know, that there is a God who he is holy. And we have no right to stand in his presence if it were not for what he's done for us in Jesus. But in his holiness, he is also a good and loving God. And Solomon lands on that. He is so certain. That's where he starts in his response to God. In fact, he goes on and he talks about how God had kept David on the throne and has given him now a son in his place on the throne. And verse 7 picks up in Solomon's response again to God's question. And we're going to get to the second thing that Solomon knows. "And now, O Lord, my God, you have made your servant king in place of David, my father, although I am but a little child and do not know how to go out or to come in." Now, bear in mind that Solomon's likely around about age 20. He would have spent the last two decades being prepared to be king. I mean, David didn't just at the end stumble upon like, oh no, what do I do? I gotta find someone to be a successor. No, there's a plan and clearly some thought that's going into this. So Solomon has had the advantage of all the preparation and all the training, and still he gets to this point where God comes and Solomon recognizes that God is a God of love, and Solomon recognizes a second thing. I am not fit for the task. I don't even know how to go out and in myself, let alone lead a nation to do this. I am in over my head, essentially, is what he's saying. That's the second thing he knows. And that's a very, if you've ever been in that spot, man, it's an uncomfortable spot to be in life. And yet, it sets us up for the next thing that Solomon knows, which is a wonderful thing. That is that because of God's great love and God's presence, we can come to him in prayer and we can ask for the very thing we need. Look at verse 9. "Give your servant, therefore..." Now, I'm going to read it exactly as it reads in English, and I'm going to suggest a slight alternative reading here in a second. "Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to govern this, your great people?" There's his request. Now, let me just let you know that when the English says understanding mind, it literally means give me a hearing heart. That would be the best literal translation, which is a wonderful statement and also is sort of a prelude to what really becomes the problem in Solomon's life, that his heart eventually will drift from the Lord. This is not an intellectual, this is not Solomon saying, "You want to know what I need, God? I just need some more facts. I need more information. If I could just fill my head with like all the legislation and the laws and just have a whole bunch of information on international politics and size of armies, and then I'd be able to govern. He's like, I need to hear. I love the answer in part because I feel like it's so counter again to maybe how we typically think or how our world would encourage us to think. When it would say things like this, the answer is inside you. Like, you've got everything you need inside you just to go and live and flourish. And hear what Solomon's saying? He's like, I don't. I need a heart that would hear. I need a heart that would be aware of things that are outside me. Primarily, I think what he's saying is, God, I need to be able to hear you. I'm working with a working definition of justice. Let me just try it out on you. That justice is the reordering of the world according to God's goodwill. Right? And so as you think through how God created everything, it was good, and sin destroyed it. God's justice, as you read through Scripture, is the reordering of his world according to his goodwill, his good purposes. And if that's the case, then I think what Solomon's asking for is, God, help me to hear you so that as I lead this people, I can reorder the sphere that I am responsible for according to your goodwill, because the answer is not in here. I need to be able to hear you. I don't know what God will call you to or has called you to, but I think one of the things I love in Solomon's request when God says, ask for one thing, it kind of boils down to this. Solomon asks for the one thing he needs to participate in the way God has called him for the furthering of his kingdom. If you're going to pray for something for yourself, your spouse, your kids, your grandkids, maybe that needs to show up on the prayer list. God, would you give my kids, my spouse, myself, whatever it is that I need to further your kingdom in the way you've called me to it? I think there's some wonderful joy to be had in that kind of thinking. That it's not just about, yes, we give God our resources, you know, or we give of our finances through our offerings, we give of our time in our service, but to give of your thought capacity. I was gonna say imagination, but I don't want you to start thinking I'm weird and losing it. But I'll explain what I mean. Like sometimes when I'm doing a reno, if you know me, I'm renoing all the time, way too much. I think of it lots. I will rebuild something 100 times before I ever pick up the hammer to do the job. I'm building my one garden, right? In my mind, I've built it and built it and built it and built it and built it. I imagine and think and dream about what it could be. But I think to myself, I ought not to just do that about my backyard or a home renovation. I should be doing that also in the areas that God has called me to advance his kingdom, that I'd be thinking and dreaming of what God might use me for to that end. And then praying in light of that, God, would you give me the things I lack? Because I don't just show up fully qualified for what God's called me to. I need him. Solomon sees the gap. Unless he is able to discern between what is good and evil, he will be unable to lead God's people. There's the three things that Solomon knows. He knows God is a God of love. That great word has said, that loyal, committed, faithful, compassion, and love. The second thing he knows, I am not qualified for the task. The third thing he knows is, here's what I need. I'm going to need to be able to discern. I'm going to need for my heart to be able to hear so that I have this understanding of what God's will is, so that I can then bring justice. I can bring the world that I have under my sphere to a point where it is reordered in the way God would want it. Now, pay attention to what happens next. It pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. And God said, because you asked this, you didn't ask for a long life, you didn't ask for wealth, you didn't ask for the destruction of your enemies. You ask for something that pleases me. That's a very interesting, almost provocative type language, because the statement of greatest judgment on David's life was that in the eyes of God, David had sinned. And now in the eyes of God, Solomon has done something that pleases God. And I would actually contend the way the author is telling the story, he wants you to see that even as Solomon is saying, God, would you help me discern between what is good and evil, even in the asking of the request, God is saying, it's already happening. I'm already answering it. The fact that you have requested in the way you have is actually the evidence of my answering your request, because you would have never asked that unless I was already answering it and allowing you to discern between good and evil. Isaiah chapter 65, I think it's around verse 24 that God says, even before they ask, even before the word is on their lips, I am answering. And while it is on their lips, I have already heard. It's almost like God is illustrating that truth in the life of Solomon. God, I need to be able to discern between good and evil, between what is right and wrong, between what pleases you and doesn't. God's like, oh, Solomon, yes. Even in the asking of that is evidence of my answer to you. And so God commits to bless Solomon in some amazing ways. And then we get to the end of it. Solomon awoke in verse 15, and behold, it was a dream. Like I said, not just a dream, but a dream. And he came to Jerusalem, stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, and offered up burnt offerings and peace offerings, and made a feast for all his servants. Just say it quickly. This is kind of a high point. This is the first time we see Solomon in Jerusalem worshiping before the Ark, and he's taken the posture of a servant, because a servant before a king would stand, and now a servant in the presence of God, this is the king in the presence of God, stands before God, showing himself to be a servant of God. And there he is, worshiping God as a result of this incredible encounter that he's had with God. Now, the question becomes, what would happen next? If God would give a king that kind of wisdom and bless him in those kind of ways, you would expect the next story would probably be, and then Solomon led his armies out and defeated his enemies in spectacular fashion, or, and then he made some sort of business transaction, or then he built some spectacular building. He did some amazingly prominent thing that we all stood back and went, wow, what a king. And the next story that is clearly meant to fit with the scene we've just read reads like this. Then two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. Two prostitutes, who in Israel, it's actually forbidden to be a prostitute. And so the fact that you'd have two of them and then two of them able to gain access to the king is just the most puzzling, unexpected scene you would ever imagine. But there they are before the king. And the one woman said, oh, my Lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. And then on the third day after I gave birth, the woman also gave birth, and we were alone. And this, there was no one else with us in the house. There were only two of us in the house. And this woman's son died in the night because she laid on him. And she arose at midnight, took my son from beside me while your servant slept, and laid him at her breast, and laid her dead son at my breast. And when I rose in the morning to nurse my child, behold, he was dead. But when I looked closely at him in the morning, behold, he was not the child that I bore. And the other woman said, no, the living child is mine. The dead child is yours. And the first said, no, the dead child is yours. And the living child is mine. Thus they spoke before the king. Notice they're not speaking to the king anymore by this point. They're standing in front of the king. And here's these two grieving, distraught moms having an epic argument. And probably even as I read it, you're having trouble. It's like keeping track, like, okay, who? who's who? What's going on in the story? What's interesting is, again, the way it's written in Hebrew is so different than English, in the sense that in English, they've tried to fix it for us so that we actually understand the outcome of the story. In Hebrew, you get to the end of it, and you actually, as the reader, don't know who actually is the mom. It's the most puzzling picture imaginable. And there in the middle of it comes this moment, like, where they're arguing, and if you're reading it objectively, you're like, there is no chance for anyone to ever figure this out. Like, how would you determine that? Two women, one baby, both saying the baby is theirs. Like, that's the point. The point is, humanly speaking, there is no answer to this situation. You could never resolve it. But what has just happened in the previous scene? God told Solomon that he would give him the ability, a God-giving ability, to discern between what is good and evil, what is right and wrong, what is pleasing to the Lord and not. And so Solomon said, verse 23, well, the one says the son that is alive, the one says, this is my son that is alive and yours is dead. The other says, no, your son is dead and mine is the living one. The king said, bring me a sword. Now, I don't think for a second Solomon ever thought he was actually going to cut the baby in half. The action, the situation is the way he's going to resolve the situation. And again, if you don't know the story, read the whole thing sometime. It's Amazing how God gives him wisdom to walk through this situation. Upon the production of the sword, of course, the one who is the actual mom to the baby doesn't want her baby harmed and is willing to give up the baby to the other mom rather than having him harmed. And then, hence, they were able to figure out whose son is whose. And they get to verse 28. All Israel heard of the judgment that the king had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king because they perceived the wisdom of God. See how that concludes Solomon's request to God? The wisdom that Solomon is going to get to govern his people. The impossibility of this situation that Solomon's going to be able to walk through when, humanly speaking, there is no way to walk through it. Now you're thinking, okay, that's good. So we see prayer. God answers prayer. That's great. But your original supposition, Don, was that God answers the prayer of imperfect people in imperfect situations. And all you've done is shown us the king of Israel who God answers his prayer. You couldn't have picked a more unlikely candidate. Of course, God's going to answer his prayer. He's this amazing guy. We've all read about him. He's the wisest man, and God handpicks him. It's like, of course, if you're saying that that's supposed to be the template, well then, I am no Solomon, and God's never going to hear my prayer. But look at how chapter 3 starts, and this would be the important piece. And I apologize that we don't have a ton of time, but I think we can do it in just a couple minutes. Verse 1, Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So, remember how not that long before the Israelites were slaves in Egypt? And they were told when God delivered them that they were not to enter into covenants and political treaties with foreign people, that they were to trust that God would be the one who would care for them and deliver them. And what's like the first thing Solomon does? Because chapter 2 gets us to the point where now Solomon is the king and he's firmly kind of set in power. And it's like his first action, let's go make a treaty with the Egyptians. His second action goes on, verse 1. He took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her into the city of David. He marries a foreign queen. In fact, if you go look in chapter 11, verse 1 to 3, you'll see that this is sort of the beginning of the end, in a manner of speaking. It's this very issue that will eventually lead him away from the living God. He will just take wife after wife after wife, and he will not only take the wives, he will eventually begin to incorporate their gods into his own worship, into his own confidence. And so you see, not only has he entered into a treaty with a foreign country, he's then married the daughter of the Pharaoh to secure that treaty. And he's now married a foreign woman, which again, two things that the king of Israel was forbidden to do. The third thing, he couldn't bring her into his house right away. Why? Because he was still building it. And this is interesting. Don't just ignore these little moments in 1 Kings. He brought her into the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord. Now, anyone who knew the order, because people reading this in the ancient world would have known the order, he built the temple first, because he takes 7 years to build the temple and 13 to build his own house. And so the order here is switched. So you would read it going, that's odd. 1 Kings chapter 3 changed the order around. It's done that way so that you would kind of like trip on it going, oh, I see. Solomon put more effort into his own house than the house of the Lord. As grand and glorious as it was, he actually used forced labor, another thing forbidden by the king to do. He used his own people, forced them into labor. He actually put his country in hock. He actually defaulted on a loan. He essentially bankrupted the nation of Israel, building his house. He had to give away 20 cities, 1 Kings chapter 9, to pay off the debt he incurred to build his house. And then, as if that weren't enough, look at verse 2. The people were sacrificing at high places, however, because no house had yet been built for the name of the Lord. Foreign alliance, foreign wife, prioritizing his own house, leaving his people unable to worship their God in the way that he would have instructed, because they are not to do this. They're not to go to the high places. Deuteronomy chapter 12 makes it really clear. This is a no-no. They're only to go to the places that God has prescribed, and here they are. And the way it's described, it's not like villainizing the people. It's villainizing their king who failed in his duty to build the place he ought to have built so they could go and worship God. And then verse 3. Just to make it a little more confusing, Solomon loved the Lord. Like, okay, what do you do with that mess? He loved the Lord, by the way, because in 2 Samuel 12, I think it is, the Lord loved Solomon. It's just like the New Testament says, we love because he first loved us. In fact, Solomon ends up with a nickname, Jedidiah, beloved by the Lord. It's a mess. That's what I want you to see. This is a mess. It's a man who both loves the Lord and he loves his palace. He loves the Lord and he loves his political treaties. He loves the Lord and he loves his wives. He loves the Lord, but not enough to make sure there's a temple for his people to worship. He loves the Lord, but he himself will go to the high places at Gibeah to worship the Lord there. And in the middle of all that mess, God comes to him one night and says, Solomon, speak to me, ask of me, and I will answer. Prayer is not for perfect people. Prayer is for imperfect people in imperfect situations because we have a perfect, glorious God. Never forfeit the opportunity that God has given you, the privilege that he has given you as his people to come into his presence. Do not believe the lie that God would listen to the prayers of someone else, but not me. Because prayer has always been and always will be for imperfect people. Again, it doesn't mean we just stay there and go, great, I don't have to grow in my faith and righteousness. It's like, no, we do. We want to. But it doesn't mean we forfeit the privilege of coming to the Lord in prayer.